Working Cows Podcast, Episode 58.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy everybody, it's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, brought to you by the Global Ag Network. We have on the show today Nate Chisholm. Nate is the author of Savannah, How Modern Problems Were Born Out of Prehistoric Extinctions. And we're going to talk to Nate a little bit about his philosophy of ranching and how he is using his animals to improve the land and how he has gone about getting into the ranching industry. So, Nate, thank you for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for having me.
So, we were put in touch by Ariel Greenwood, somebody I was introduced to by actually another guest of the Working Cows Podcast, Luke Perman. And she had labeled herself and maybe lumped you in there as well as a weird rancher, and we don't know exactly how that term is defined. I don't think there is a dictionary definition for it, but what do you think of when it comes to the paradigm of the ranching industry that maybe you're challenging, I guess?
First of all, thanks so much for having me and for caring what we have to say out here. You know, I guess I don't really want to tell anybody what to think or what to be or what's weird or what's right, but I think that there probably is a certain logic to the fact that most ranchers kind of trace a direct lineage back 150 years or 100 years or whatever to people that started doing it out a certain way. And their lineage kind of evolved as one cohort, kind of. And so, right or wrong, oftentimes a lot of what happens in that world is right, and sometimes there's probably things that we could do better. But yeah, that's kind of, I guess, if I had to define it, I haven't really thought about it before, but that's what I'd say is, you know, things that developed under certain conditions and then have evolved into this after 100 years of history. And some of what happened is adaptive and some of it isn't quite anymore. And then the weird ones are the ones that are coming into it from something else. And again, a lot of times we find out that the way things are done has a lot more value than you realize sitting from the outside, but there's also some interesting new perspectives that we have. I find myself doing things more the normal way all the time, probably, but I do have some differences, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, maybe a bit more fair-minded way to come at this is from just a practicality sense that there are certain things that we have to be willing to do differently from an economic and an ecologic standpoint. So what brought you into ranching, I guess, would be my first question here.
Yeah, I came to ranching from ecology, really. I didn't grow up in a ranching or agricultural background, but I had a interest growing up as a kid in nature that turned into an interest in grass specifically, and then just started working on ranches around the world, sort of. So yeah, my entree into it all was through ecology. That's my main framework for seeing it. And so I guess I see what I'm doing out there as an ecologist and not really as a rancher per se. You know, I still have to pay the bills. I have to pay the bills with cattle, and in the same way that anybody else does. But I approach my way of figuring out how to do that as an ecologist, you know, as in how are all the different organisms out here interacting in a way that's going to turn sunlight into protein that we can all use, you know, us being top carnivores in this system. So, yeah, that's sort of my paradigm, I guess, if you want to put it into the rubric, into your podcast rubric, you know?
Yeah, definitely. You know, and that is a paradigm that we are very much fond of here at the Working Cows Podcast, that we are first and foremost managers of grass and managers right. of the natural resources that we have. And I think maybe the paradigm that has been in place for a long time has been ranchers as managers of cows and not necessarily as stewards of grass. Now, there's always some limited sense in which ranchers have viewed themselves as needing to have grass for cows to eat, but maybe not so much in the sense of how my cows interact with that grass will affect the way that grass regenerates and the soil life that's going on underneath of it. And, you know, I mean, a lot of it is related to the fact that we have had advances in technology that have allowed us to see into that soil and see what's actually going on there at a microbial level, and a lot of the things that we are able to do to impact that in a positive way with animals is something that we are becoming more and more aware of as time goes on with the ranching industry as a whole.
Yeah, and I guess from a anthropology of a normal rancher perspective, you know, you can see how that kind of evolved from 150 years ago in the open range days or whatever, when grass was something that happened to you. You know, it wasn't, you had no control over how any of that range was managed. And, you know, even if you had legal control, you didn't have a lot of technological tools to make it happen. So it just made sense for everybody to just focus on the things that they had control over. And that was, you know, how do we get all those darn cattle in, you know, so we can take them to the railroad. And so that's kind of evolved, you know, now into the sort of mindset that we've got in a lot of ways in the industry. But there's, you know, like you say, I'm like, well, like I say sometimes, you know, we need a lot more industrial ecologists, you know, where you've got a situation where you're using ecology to solve the problems of society, the same way that, you know, there were engineers only came after Newton's principles of mechanics, you know. And so there have been people that were making stuff long before Newton came along and that sort of thing, but it was a little haphazard. And so now with some understanding of ecology, you introduce that into ranching and you all of a sudden have a new powerful way of creating wealth and value by using ecology, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the people that has influenced me through this journey in the Working Cows podcast, Steve Kenyon, the mission statement of his ranch is economic and ecologic sustainability for generations. You know, that's what he's trying to do. And they're, it's a both and deal, you know, and they're tied together. I would say more probably, well, you can use money to influence ecology, but it's going to be artificial. If you are attacking ecology from a natural perspective, there will be an economic benefit return to you, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, in a lot of ways, to keep riffing on the weird rancher, normal rancher theme, normal ranchers see ecology as something that's sort of peripheral or like a luxury item that people who don't know how to do real stuff use and think about. And I get that, actually. More and more I get that, the more I'm in ranching world. But I guess I would just say that, you know, physics and chemistry were probably viewed the same way 200 or 300 years ago as the plaything of rich kids, you know? And they kind of evolved into the modern world, you know? Those disciplines have now been used to reshape the way the world operates, for better or for worse. And, you know, I think there's probably a good chance that in 200 years we'll see ecology, you know, sort of evolving on the same trajectory as a discipline.
So you mentioned that ecology brought you into ranching. What was the, and you said that grass specifically, what was that, how did that trajectory look for you? What was the initial interest, and then what were some of the influences along the way that brought you into more and more involvement in the ranching industry?
Yeah, just ever since I was a kid, I liked plants and animals. And so from one perspective, you could say it'd be logical that I go into ranching, but we think of, you know, most ranchers interact with the world so much through technology that that's kind of obscured that we make our living through plants and animals, and the machines are just ways of doing it. The machines and the buildings and the, you know, the everything else. But, you know, so I just, you know, there was a little park close to the house that I lived at in Madison. My parents are, you know, my mom ran a small business, marketing business, and my dad was an electrical engineer, is an electrical engineer. And there was just a park near our house, conservation park, and I just kind of saw how I'd go every single day, and I just kind of saw how that all changed and started volunteering there, cutting brush and planting grass and that kind of stuff. And then that got me reading about different things and kind of alternative ways of managing ecosystem health with chainsaws and cattle. And I started working for ranchers, you know, starting right there in Wisconsin, and then went to school at the University of Montana, and so out in Montana, and then, you know, eventually I was in Africa for a year working on ranches out there, and yeah, just kind of absorbing as I went along, and then ended up in California working on places, and then started picking up leases with my business partner in our business down in California, Byron Palmer, and we just started picking up a few leases as they came up next to us, and contract grazing on that until now me and my wife bought this property in Oregon. So we've got production in California in the wintertime, and then in the summertime we run cattle up here.
And what was the nature of your work in Africa? We'll start there.
Just sort of being somebody that didn't know what they're doing, and just kind of meeting people and working on their ranches for free, mostly, until I kind of built up some skills. And then I'd do low stress stock handling stuff on some of these places where they had a problem animal situation. I'm a long time devotee, I guess, of Bud Williams. Yeah, just kind of going around. It was a good way to kind of see the world and learn some stuff.
What part of Africa were you in?
I started out in South Africa, but I ended up going probably to 10 different countries or something like that. for at least a little bit. Just kind of bouncing around.
And what kind of ranching were you involved in there? What was there?
Kind of the whole gamut. You know, big conventional ranching that looks fairly similar to what we'd see out here, to just, you know, people walking around with sticks and cattle and goats or whatever. So mostly I would say it was commercial ranches that were, when I say conventional, just more like modern commercial operations, but a lot of it was somehow involved or intertwined with the holistic management universe.
A lot of the non-conventional were involved with holistic management,
just a lot of the commercial ranchers, or one way or the other, were involved somehow in holistic management.
And commercial as opposed to subsistence or
exactly
herder types.
Got right. It.
And then you mentioned that you started to see a different way of working with the land through chainsaws and cattle. Did I get that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's really been me learning about normal ranching, you know? I didn't come to it with any sort of sense of what normal ranching was, so my first introduction to ranching was, you know, as a way of influencing ecosystem processes. So, I'm also real interested in forestry, and I'm sort of integrating that into what I do out here. So, yeah, chainsaws, cattle.
And how are you using chainsaws and cattle to change the landscape, impact the landscape in a positive way?
I guess from a big picture idea of my paradigm, I kind of see it as what we have to do is mimic the way large herds of megafauna, large groups of megafauna, used to move on the landscape. And that includes megafauna that's, you know, extinct megafauna that's, you know, elephant-sized animals. And in that realm, chainsaws are a viable option. You know, I think that it's not commonly known that, you know, until humans arrived on this continent and just about and every single other continent except Antarctica, there was East Africa-style large animals everywhere. And in all likelihood, it was people that ended that situation. And so my paradigm, my focus, is trying to mimic and restore some elements of that world in my land management.
So are you talking about like the less trees and more forest type of way of thinking? Is that what you're referring to?
I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of allergic to buzzwords, so I'm not exactly sure what that's referring to, but I think that before humans came along, the paleoecological evidence seems to indicate that we had wider spacing of trees, more undergrowth, more herbaceous undergrowth vegetation. You know, the deserts weren't quite as dry, the swamps weren't quite as wet. That's my interpretation, at least. That coming from the way big animals, you know, 5-ton ground sloths and mammoths, all the way down to pronghorns that were 2 feet high, little tiny miniature pronghorns, all lived on this continent, and they moved in ways that are completely lost to us, but which tended to favor, you know, savanna vegetation over the sort of vegetation that we currently think of as natural on the landscape. And so trying to mimic that sort of thing. So when you come to a place that's all trees, cut some of those trees, get them out of there, and you'll have a whole lot more species in the understory, as long as you keep on it with grazing animals so that the herbaceous vegetation can overtake the woody vegetation. And when you come to a place where there's no trees, figure out how to get some trees to grow. That's kind of, in a nutshell, that's kind of a lot of it from the big picture.
Very cool. I think I appreciate your allergy to buzzwords. The way I articulated it is just the closest anyone has come on the Working Cows podcast to even touching on the ideas of silvopasture. So I was using what I knew to try and tip the conversation in that direction, but I think that is what you're talking about, that you're cutting down smaller, less viable trees, and you're preserving the larger ones, and the freeing up some of that ground and that soil life to produce, as you said, more herbaceous vegetation.
Yeah, and it's kind of hard to know exactly how far to get into all of this. I wrote a book, and I have a daily or a weekly blog that I use as a launch pad to talk about some of those ideas, which is meadowsbrooksandgroves.com is the blog site, and the book can be found there too. But just thinking about it as the biomes that we're left with right now are kind of the result of the fact that we've lost one of the major shapers of vegetation on the face of the planet, and that's these large animals that used to be a really strong influence on vegetation. And I think in the fossil evidence, I think indicates that you had less of the sort of biomes that we see now, like forests, steppes, deserts, and more of kind of a intermingling of it all. So there's sort of a savanna component to vegetation all over the continent, as you had forests being opened up by big elephant-like animals, and you didn't see fires to such the extent that you do, like where you are in the northern plains, that created huge treeless steppes. So there was more grass in places that are currently dense forest, and there's more trees in current places that are currently, treeless grasslands.
Awesome. No, let's just assume that you can get as nerdy as you want on the Working Cows podcast.
Oh boy, pretty nerdy.
No, really, that's cool. This is episode 58 of the Working Cows podcast. I will link to Nate's blog and Nate's book at workingcows.net/58, and we'll, as we work towards wrapping up, I'll get some more information from Nate about what things he would like to see there as well. But I wanted to continue on through Nate's trajectory and talk about the strategy of ranching in California and in Oregon. What is that, a cash flow issue? You're running some other people's cows in one place part of the year and then some other people's cows in the other place part of the year? Or how is that? What's that strategy?
Yeah, so kind of the big picture has been us trying to get a system where we've got green grass year-round. And we pretty much do have that with the land down in California is winter range. So we get rain start in December, say, and things are green until through June. And then here in Oregon, the water, our flood ground, which is all our ground, dries up in April, and then we start to get floods again in in November. And so that we've pretty much got green grass year round. And yeah, it is a cash flow issue. Like any business, I guess any startup business, we are just very strapped for cash. And so contract grazing has been our primary way of turning our grass into money. And yeah, we work with a number of producers who some of them need winter range, some of them need summer range, and that's kind of the business model.
Very cool. I really appreciate that different way of getting into the industry and the, you know, looking at it from a practical standpoint of finding green grass year round. Very, very much, I think, maybe a luxury of your location. Pretty cool opportunity that it seems like you've got there. What was the nature of the land that you purchased in Oregon when you took it over? What did it look like? What were some of the infrastructure that was available? Some of those things.
Yeah, it hasn't changed enough, probably, by most people's standards. We got it. This is our second year on it. I don't know about most people's standards, but definitely by my standards. It's in low-lying, ditched and drained swamp, really. It's most of it lies at about 5 feet above sea level. We're in the river valley, and the river has a tidal influence. So we're 20 miles from the ocean, but we still get a big tidal signal, even though it's fresh water. So there's some pretty simple cowboy engineering solutions to keep that dry, to basically build one-way valves using the tidal influence so that water goes out at low tide and can't come back in during high tide, that keeps this land productive pasture. So that's there. We've been in a major process in the last 2 years of revamping our tidal or our tide control infrastructure so that we can better drain out and then irrigate in the summer, because we drain out in April and then we use those same ditches to irrigate using flood irrigation. So basically we just put the valves and using the power of the moon, the tides push fresh water back onto our pastures for irrigation without any pumping or without any anything. So it's kind of another unique feature of our location. But that's what we're doing. We're in the process of changing that. We're in the process of putting in fencing and water infrastructure. My pastures were pretty neglected in a lot of ways, and so we had a lot of kind of swampy vegetation that likes to grow under sort of lower stocking rates and lower densities and not much movement of cattle. And so been pretty extensively using mowing to control that and to get that vegetation down so that we're starting to favor the plants that have developed symbiotic relationships with grazing animals instead of the plants that haven't. So that's how a weird rancher says it. The normal rancher says it. You mow to get the good grass. The outcome, I guess, is the same. Kind of more windy, long and windy road to it when you do it the weird way. And what else? We're in the process of hopefully leasing some ground near us that's a clear cut that wasn't replanted, and then planting it with both grass and trees to use that as our winter grazing resource as a silver pasture, if you want to use another buzzword that's starting to seem like it's moving into not buzzword territory, but I'd just call it a savanna. Starting to get both grazing and industrial forest wood product use out of that property.
And so a savanna, the presence of a savanna in your mind would be the indication of a balanced ecosystem? Is that kind of what you're saying?
Not really. I would say that somebody really wanted to see me. Dada was running away because he was doing the interview on the phone, huh? Yeah, well, here. Come on out here, bud. Come on out here. Let's do the interview together. See if you can tell everybody when Dad is full of it, making up stories that aren't true. I'd say my definition of a savanna is, a savanna is different from a forest when you get more herbaceous vegetation in the understory than you have leaf litter from the overstory. If that makes any sense.
Yep.
You know? Yeah, that's not too metaphysical or anything like that. I don't rely on saying, balanced and healthy necessarily, but just, I think that because of the evolutionary history of these systems, you're going to have a lot more species, you're going to have a lot more production in a system that's like that than in one where you either don't have any trees or the trees are dominating to the extent that you don't have any herbaceous component to the ecosystem. Grass or wildflowers or whatever, weeds.
Living where I do, I've seen both. I've been on the Great Plains, and then I've been in the Black Hills, South Dakota, and we run cows in both places. So it's a fascinating conversation about how we can use animals to impact that in a way that is going to attract more diversity and species and different things like that. So I've used up all the time I told you I would take, and I see your blog, very well taken care of blog at meadowsbrooksandgroves.com, and your book, Savannah, How Modern Problems Were Born Out of Prehistoric Extinctions. I hope what we've done is whetted some appetites for people to become regular consumers of your content and people to purchase your book. And there will be links to both of those things at workingcows.net/58. Anything else you'd like me to link to?
No, that'll do it. I'll be excited to keep following workingcows.net in the future, too, now that I've been exposed to you guys.
Yeah. No, and I as a fellow content creator, I would relish the opportunity to talk to you about future content that you create.
Yeah, for sure. It would be good to compare notes and all that kind of stuff, strategies.
Very good. Thank you, Nate, for your time today.
Thank you very much, Clay.
Very interesting discussion there with Nate. Really appreciate him taking the time to sit down with us and just challenge our paradigms and challenge our thinking, and I hope to continue to talk to Nate. He's got a great blog that I hope you will check out over at meadowsbrooksandgroves.com. As we mentioned today on the show, if you would like to check out Nate's blog at meadowsbrooksandgroves.com or buy his book, it will be linked at the show notes page, workingcows.net/58. Also, coming up next week, we're going to take a lot different approach. I was gifted a portable recorder by someone who went to workingcows.net/support and clicked on the Amazon wish list, and they sent me a portable recorder. So I was in Rapid City, South Dakota for the 2018 Farm Bureau State Convention as a member of the Young Farmers and Ranchers Committee, and we hosted a panel discussion on local food, some really great stuff, and I hope to get some of those panelists on the Working Cows podcast and talk to them about what they're doing in their environment to bring local food to more people. But there was some comments made by one of the people that was a little bit skewed, or maybe a lot skewed, away from corn-fed beef and feedlot-fed beef and those kinds of things. A big theme of Farm Bureau, especially with the diversity of people that are represented in Farm Bureau, is coming together as one in agriculture and not not putting hurdles in between other sectors, even within our own niche in agriculture, and making it more difficult for them to succeed. So we went up to one of my friend's hotel rooms, actually, episode 7. Josh Sebisma sat down with me, and we discussed his hoop beef system. And we went up to his hotel room and kept their tradition alive of recording an episode of the Working Cows podcast during Farm Bureau's convention. I used that portable recorder. I think it turned out serviceable. It's going to be a recording that we can use. And we talked about kind of their operation. And then another young man, Calvin DeBoer, also joined me. And we talked about his operation. We had three of us there together in a discussion about, you know, the safety of corn-fed beef and implanted cattle and vaccinations and all those different things, antibiotics. So just kind of wanted to give them an opportunity to share their side of the story. And as I said, I hope to get the chef on and talk to him about his perspective as well. But you can look forward to that next week on the Working Cows podcast for episode 60, actually, because we're going to have a bonus episode for episode 59 with Kyle Schell, the May featured producer for the South Dakota Grassland Coalition. I know it's not May. I know I've got some catching up to do, and I'm going to try and do that before the end of the year, catch up on some of these bonus episodes with South Dakota Grassland Coalition featured producers in the Grassland Planner. If you have no idea what I'm talking about, way back at the first part of the year, I recorded a few episodes with some of them. I'll link to those on the show notes page for this episode, and then you can look for a bonus episode coming at the end of this week with Kyle Schell, who was from the Schell Ranch of Wasta, South Dakota, featured producers for May and the South Dakota Grassland Coalition. I've talked enough. Bonus episode Friday. Next week we will have an episode with Josh Sebisma and Calvin DeBoer on corn-fed beef and kind of their perspective on that and how it is all handled. So check that out, workingcows.net, for all of those episodes. We will see you Friday. We will see you next week on the Working Cows podcast.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.